The Alan Watts iPhone app is now available on the iTunes App Store, featuring the entire Alan Watts podcast series at your fingertips. Visit alanwattsapp.com for more information.
The difficulty of control. Are you wise enough to play at being God? And to understand what that question means, we've got to go back to metaphysical assumptions underlying Western common sense. And whether you are a Jew or a Christian or an agnostic or an atheist, you are not uninfluenced by the whole tradition of Western culture, the models of the universe which it has employed, which influence our very language, the structure of our thought, the very constitution of logic, which you're going into, say, computers. The Western model of the universe is political and engineering or architectural. It is natural for a child to ask its mother, "How was I made?" It would be inconceivable for a Chinese child to ask, "How was I made?" It might ask, "How was I grown?" or "How did I grow?" but not, "How was I made?" as if I were an artifact, something put together, something which is a construct. But all Western thought is based on the idea that the universe is a construct. And even when we got rid of the idea of the constructor, the personal God, we continued to think of the world in terms of a machine, in terms, say, of Newtonian mechanics, and later in terms of what we call quantum mechanics, although I find it rather difficult to understand how quantum theory is in any sense mechanics. It's much more like organics, which is to me a different concept. However, that may be. It has percolated, you see, into the roots of our common sense that the world is a construct, is an artifact. And therefore, as one understands the operations of a machine by analysis of its parts, by separating them into their original bits, we have bitted the cosmos and see everything going on in terms of bits, bits of information, and have found that this is extremely fruitful in enabling us to control what's happening. After all, the whole of Western technology is the result of bitting. Let's suppose, you know, you want to eat a chicken. You can't eat the whole chicken at once. You have to bite it. You have to reduce it to bits. But you don't get a cut-up fryer out of an egg. It doesn't come that way. So what has happened is this, that we don't know the origins of all this. It's maybe go back thousands of years. The way we develop the art of thinking, which is essentially calculus, is this. The universe as it comes in nature, the physical universe, is something like a Rorschach blot. It's all wiggles. We who live in cities are not really used to this because we build everything in straight lines and rectangles and so on. Wherever you see this sort of thing, you know human beings have been around because they're always trying to straighten things out. But nature itself is clouds, is water, is the outlines of continents, is mountains, is biological existences, and all of them wiggle. And wiggly things are to human consciousness a little bit of a nuisance, because we want to figure it out. And it is as if, therefore, some ancient fisherman one day held up his net and looked at the world through the net. And he said, "My, just think of that. There I can see the view, and it's one And that peak of that mountain is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 holes across. And the base is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 holes down. Now I've got its number. See? And so the lines of latitude and longitude, the lines of celestial and terrestrial latitude and longitude, the whole idea of a matrix, of a looking at things through graph, paper painted on, printed on cellophane, is the basic idea of measurement. This is the way we calculate. We break down the wiggliness of the world into comprehensible, countable, geometrical units, and thereby figure it and construct it in those terms. And this is so successful, up to a point, that we can, of course, come to imagine that this is the way the physical world really is. Discrete, discontinuous, full of points. In fact, a mechanism. But I want to just put into your mind the notion that this may be the prejudice of a certain personality type. You see, in the history of philosophy and poetry and art, we always find the interchange of two personality types, which I call prickles and goo. The prickly people are advocates of intellectual porcupinism. They want a rigor. They want precise statistics. And they have a certain clipped attitude in their voices. And you know this very well in academic circles, where there are people who are always edgy like that. And they accuse other people of being disgustingly vague and miasmic and mystical. But the vague, miasmic, and mystical people accuse the prickly people of being mere skeletons with no flesh on their bones. And they say to you, you just rattle. You're not really a human being. You know the words, but you don't know the music. And so therefore, if you belong to the prickly type, you hope that the ultimate constituent of matter is particles. If you belong to the gooey type, you hope it's waves. If you are prickly, you're a classicist. And if you're gooey, you're a romanticist. And going back into medieval philosophy, if you're prickly, you're a nominalist. If you're gooey, you're a realist. And so it goes. But we know very well that this natural universe is neither prickles nor goo exclusively. It's gooey prickles and prickly goo. And you see, it all depends on your level of magnification. If you've got your magnification on something so that the focus is clear, you've got a prickly point of view. You've got structure, shape, clearly outlined, sharply defined. When you look out of focus, it's going to go bleh, and you've got goo. But we're always playing with the two, because it's like the question is the world basically stuff, like matter, or is it basically structure? Well, we find out, of course, today that in science we don't consider the idea of matter, of there being some sort of stuff, because supposing you wanted to describe stuff, in what terms would you describe it? You always have to describe it in terms of structure, something countable, something that can be designated as a pattern. So we never get to any basic stuff. It seems to me that this way of thinking is based on a form of consciousness which we could best call scanning. The capacity to divide experiences into bits is somehow related to a physical facility which corresponds to sweeping a radar beam or a spotlight over the environment. The advantage of the spotlight is it gives you intensely concentrated light on restricted areas. A floodlight, by comparison, has less intensity. But if you examine, say, this room in total darkness, and you use the spotlight, very thin beam and you scanned the room with it, you would have to retain in memory all the areas over which it passed, and then by an additive process, you would make out the contours of the room. And it seems to me that this is something in which civilized man, both in the East and in the West, has specialized. In a method of paying attention to things which we call noticing. And therefore it's highly selective. It picks out. It's punctive. It picks out features in the environment which we say are noteworthy and which we therefore register with a notation. Be it the notation of words, the notation of numbers, or such a notation, say, as algebra or music. So that we notice those things, only those things, for which we have notation. When a child, very often child, will point at something and say to its parents, "What's that?" And they're not clear what the child is pointing to. The child has pointed to something which we consider is not a thing. The child has pointed to an area, say, of funny pattern on a dirty wall, and has noticed a figure on it. But the child doesn't have a word for it and says, "What's that?" And the adult says, "Oh, that's just a mess." Because that doesn't count for us as a thing. So you come through this to the understanding, what do you mean by a thing? It's very fascinating to ask children, what do you mean by a thing? And they don't know, because it's one of the unexamined suppositions of the culture. What do you mean by an event? Well, everybody knows what an event is, but nobody can say. Because a thing is a think. It's a unit of thought, like an inch is a unit of measurement. And so we thing the world, that is to say, in order to measure a curve, you have to reduce it to point instants. And apply the calculus, so in exactly the same way, in order to discuss or talk about the universe, you have to reduce it to things. But each thing, or think, is, as it were, one grasp of that spotlight. Going ch, 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 like this, you see. So we reduce the infinite wiggliness of the world to grasps or bits. We're getting back to biting, you see, the idea of the teeth. To grasps of thought. And so we thereby describe the world in terms of things, just as that fisherman could describe his view by the number of net hole over through which the view was showing. And this has been the immensely and apparently successful enterprise of all technological culture, superbly emphasized by ourselves.
Been listening to Alan Watts from the Spoken Word Library of the Electronic University. For copies of this and other Alan Watts programs, please go to alanwatts.com on the World Wide Web or call us toll-free at 1-800-WO-WATTS. That's alanwatts.com or 1-800-WO-WATTS. The Watts website features free audio downloads, program lists, and information on Watts' life and works. Once again, That's alanwatts.com or 1-800-WO-WATTS.